Blog Talk Radio.
Koda, Mojuba Asheda, Mojuba Aluwa Mi, Apolabi Pega, Mojuba Araba Mi, Adesanya Awuyade, Mojuba Ogute Compound Ode Remo, Mojuba Baba, Mojuba Yeye, Mojuba Egun, to all the God children, Mojuba Egun, to all the Babalawos, the Ears, Mojuba Egungun, to all the Chiefs, Mojuba Egungun, to all the Awos, Mojuba Egungun, to all those that are listening. Who are tuned in? We give praise and thanks to the Most High. We say Ashe, 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 Ashe,
Ashe, O. Welcome to Sign of the Times, everyone. This is Queen Tahira. Sign of the Times is brought to you by the UAC, the United African Coalition for Justice and Human Rights, and New Power Radio Network. We began the UAC after the unjust Zimmerman verdict of July 2013. And we will be celebrating our anniversary month in a couple of days. So we welcome you to continue to be a part of the Sign of the Times family and New Power Radio Network, but also reach out to us. You can do that a few ways on our Facebook page at Sign of the Times. myself as Queen Tahira and New Power Radio Network. We also have a few new pages because of the comprehensive work that we're doing in the community. Please check out 99 Hip Hop Collective, which is a hip hop initiative to recognize and appreciate the political warriors and prisoners who were a part of the Attica uprising, and to acknowledge that the system has not changed. If anything, it's gotten worse. And so we are looking for hip hop artists to recognize that mass incarceration and over-prosecution, which results too often, for well over a couple of decades, in the result of inhumane treatment and violation of our citizens' human rights and their unalienable rights, which they do not give up simply because they become confined citizens. So we need everyone's help to continue to spread the word through the Hip Hop Initiative, as well as the 9-9 shutdown that's going to be happening across the nation. And we're seeking international support for this as well, where, you know, there is going to be a stoppage on that day, both on the inside and the outside. We're asking people to not go to work, to not send their children to school, to participate in any local events that may be planned around this event to, focus on mass incarceration and over prosecution. And as always, we believe in nonviolent protest. And so as we proceed and get closer and closer to the date, I'm sure that there are going to be more people coming to the table, more people who want to get involved, more people who support what we're doing. And that is simply making sure that because, you know, our brothers and sisters are paying their debt to society, that certainly doesn't mean that they deserve to be treated less than humane. And unfortunately, and in too many cases, they are. We actually have a brother, Dati Khalid, who is a normal participant in Sign of the Times Block Talk Radio, who has been persecuted. He is in solitary confinement in what they're calling a hot bay. He has been maced. We don't know his health condition at this time. We don't know if he's safe. So we're asking people to call the warden there at the penitentiary, and we'll have that information for you on our Facebook pages as well as on Sign of the Times Block Talk Radio. So please look out for that to be coming up here soon. It's unfortunate that, it's considered a crime to simply speak up and acknowledge that human rights have been violated. That should not be punishable. They should, as confined citizens, should not be forced to have to defend themselves when, there are people making money hand over fist through the private prison industry. And I say on multiple levels, all the way from making uniforms to packaging products. And of course, we know that they've always pressed license plates. So the signs and things like that that you see on the highway are often made by our confined brothers and sisters. And, you know, the skills that they learn are not necessarily transferable when and if they are ever released back into society. So the word rehabilitation has been replaced with correction and pretty much punishment. So there really is no way to fully pay a debt to society, because the debt and the whole of the debt keeps getting bigger and bigger and deeper and deeper. So we really need to band together to advocate and protect our brothers and sisters who are confined, because, you know, they're only limited by the resources that we allow them to have and by, you know, what we do on the outside to support them. So please reach out. Please touch bases with us. I am waiting on my guest, Tom Watts, who is from the White Panther Party, has been a member of the party from its inception. And I'm waiting on him to join us now. So we're going to check out a little bit of revolutionary music that Tom suggested for me. It's called Treble Army. And the title of the piece is Serve the People. So thank you for listening. My name is Queen Tahira. You're listening to Sign of the Times Block Talk Radio. If you'd like to call in, the number is 917-889-8059. And don't forget to push 1 if you'd like to make a comment or ask a question. So we're going to hang out for a little bit and vibe a little bit and get things going. And for some reason Tom has been held up, we will be having him back on the air. He's scheduled to be back again next Thursday. So, you know, when you're doing this revolutionary work, anything can happen. And hopefully Tom's okay and everything's going to move forward. So we'll be right back.
No es necesario, pues, ser gran conocedor de digamos, de la lucha, ni nada de eso. Se ve el alto grado de injusticia, pues. Entonces, no necesitas saber tanto de marxismo-leninismo ni cuestiones así. Es cuestión práctica, pues, de ver esto y sentirlo, pues. Sentir el amor hacia los compañeros campesinos también, que están tan marginados. Por eso fue nuestra incorporación a la lucha. Para enseñarle a nuestros compañeros campesinos a luchar.
That's what the Venture to the program is. A lot of people think charity, but what does it do? It takes the people from a stage to another stage to another stage. And any program is revolutionary, and in that program, revolution is change. Honey, and you just keep on changing. That's what we do. We take the people in there and take them through those changes, and before you know it, they are in fact not only knowing what socialism is, they don't even have to know what it is. They're endorsing, and they're participating, and they're observing, and they're supporting socialism.
We go by the words and deeds of Amilcar Cabral, who said that we're not fighting for ideas in people's heads. Not vocabulary, not terms. People want a better quality of life and a better future for their children. This song is inspired by the Black Panther Party's Free Breakfast for Children program, which brought the entire community together for the good of something everybody could agree on, the kids. Born in torrential rain of 1980, my generation might seem crazy if it wasn't for the counterinsurgency to eliminate militants, divisions of preference of the government, punishment of the Panthers, elders behind the cell bars, shell-shocked, jail while others got jobs. Forgot I never knew to dedicate their lives to this. Easy to criticize the youth, but there's no guiding fist. Confusion in various forms, patriot flags, American dreams, cocaine on the streets. My agent underneath to carry the torch, put flames in the hearts of babies and teens, fulfill their basic needs. Up against an oppressor stronger than ever. Comfort us with possessions, progress in question. Must equip the ghetto with struggle direction. Serve the people, earn the respect. Follow possessors, those who serve the people for survival first. Learn from practice, the kids deserve to eat without a beat. Why to be smiling, cause it's a new society. Serve the people with survival first. Learn from practice, the kids deserve to eat without a beat. Why to be smiling, cause it's a new society. Plenty of commerce cannot operate in public legal hustling, cause above ground ain't organized enough yet. They turn unwanted circumstances from burdens to further chances to pursue the purpose, revolution of the masses. We will organize and formalize collectives, borderline dying, financial source of our reluctance to be full-time freedom fighters, fortune tops lieutenants, in quarter-mile radius, proletariat lumping. Pick your local, building soldiers is your homework, miss the youngsters in the struggle. There's plenty socialists within quotes, but ain't no theory gonna give a kid a winter coat. We brought a larger world liberation movement. Gotta start on the ground and syncopated units. If we value victory, we'll demonstrate our trueness. Strip them out of discipline, convey it to recruits and learn the people for survival first. Learn from practice, the kids deserve to eat without a beat. Why to be smiling, cause it's a new society. Serve the people for survival first. Learn from practice, the kids deserve to eat without a beat. Why to be smiling, cause it's a new society.
After a time, it's by individuals like me, burglars, pimps, drug addicts, people on public assistance, welfare, alcoholics, working these programs that's serving these kids, or working the free health clinics where doctors and nurses are coming to provide services, or free clothing programs for those who are in need, people began to look at us differently. They began to engage us in a very different way, from the skepticism to gradually a sort of intimacy.
Learn from practice, the kids deserve to eat without a beat. Why to be smiling, cause it's a new society. Serve the people for survival first. Learn from practice, the kids deserve to eat without a beat. Why to be smiling, cause it's a new society. Serve the people for survival first. Learn from practice, the kids deserve to eat without a beat. Why to be smiling, cause it's a new society.
Serve the people means surrendering yourself to the health of the human family and the land base. Picking up the pieces of face destroying leaders, crippling our movements with with J. Edgar Hoover. Not charity, using poverty for profits. Objects is freedom like Sophia Bukhari. Self-determination, our consciousness evolving. Preparing by sharing, we're already an army. They gonna tell us one, we gon' heal us one. Let them know I love billions I ain't even met before. Doing the work that the federal will never do. Ain't anticipating praise on Channel 11 News. Of all the unnecessary generosities are given. Sisters, brothers, we all the same. I'll guard you with my life, shelter, listening here. Cause we one body, you heart, I'm vain.
Peace, peace. Welcome back. That was Trouble Army, and the title of that was Serve the People. We are waiting on Tom Watts to join us. Should he not be able to join us again, we have him scheduled to come back in on next week, on next Thursday. So I want to read this piece real quick about Brother Dati. It's a James Dati Khalid Pleasant, Free Alabama Movement organizer, was arbitrarily transferred from St. Clair population to Donaldson Correctional and placed in a hot bay stripped segregation unit. After repeatedly protesting the taking of all his belongings, he was sprayed with a chemical agent and placed in a shower stall the remainder of the night. And from what we understand, Brother Dati was in that shower for over 24 hours, nude after having been sprayed. For those who would like to assist, this is a brief outline. Please contact Donaldson Correctional Facility, Warden Leon Bowling, B-O-L-L-I-N-G, phone number 205-436-3681. Again, the phone number is 205-436-3681. Tell the warden or whoever it is that answers the phone, but be persistent in trying to reach the warden. Again, his name is Leon Bowling, and protest this treatment. Brother Dati had no clue or warning that they were going to be transferring him. We do believe that this is in retaliation for speaking out against the inhumane punishment that's going on in the free Alabama correctional institutions. They have spoken up and spoken up clearly. That, you know, one, they are no longer willing to, you know, just abide by not only being confined, but being punished, having to eat unsanitary food in an unsanitary environment, not having the personal care items that they need, not getting the health care that they deserve. And again, you know, simply because our brothers and sisters are confined and supposedly paying their debt back to society, that does not in any way give up their human rights and their constitutional rights and most of all their unalienable rights to be treated decently and with respect. So I am not sure what happened to my guest, Tom Watts, but hopefully, like I said, he's okay. What we'll do is check out a little bit of music, give him a little time to call in, and if he's not here by the half, then we're going to go ahead and shut down for the evening. Again, my name is Queen Tahira. You're listening to Sign of the Times Blog Talk Radio, brought to you by New Power Radio Network. We'll be right back. Everyone, this is Queen Tahira. We're going to go ahead and check out some Robert Williams, Let It Burn, as a listening session tonight. I apologize that my guest has not shown up. I hope he's okay. But please check out Robert Williams, Let It Burn. If you don't know who Robert Williams is, do yourself a favor and look him up. All right, y'all, we'll see you tomorrow night at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time here on Sign of the Times. Thank you for checking us out, and stay tuned for Robert Williams' Let It Burn.
Embassy in Dar es Salaam, Republic of Tanzania, East Africa. A demonstration is taking place by the revolutionary African students and university students against the U.S. policy in Vietnam. With me is Robert Franklin Williams, the president in exile of the New Republic of Africa, recently formed in the United States. Rob Williams is a U.S. citizen who left the United States in 1961, pursued by the FBI and the police of the state of North Carolina. He lived in Cuba from 1961 to 1966, broadcasting to the United States on his own radio program, Radio Free Dixie, and sending in copies of his monthly newsletter, The Crusader. Since 1966, he's been resident in Peking, China, where he has continued sending his newsletter, The Crusader, into the United States. Rob is considered one of the best-known leaders of the Black Nationalist Movement.
Rob, I notice you're wearing a button of the of Chairman Mao Zedong.
Yes, I got it in Peking because the Cultural Revolution is going on there, and that I'm being supported by the Chinese people, so naturally I would support the Chinese people in their Cultural Revolution.
Well, I'd like to start this interview. I think a lot of our viewers, people in the United States, many may be familiar with the circumstances under which Robert Franklin Williams left the United States in 1961. You were a fugitive at that time. You were under, there was a warrant out for your arrest for kidnapping in the state of North Carolina, and I believe also for interstate flight by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Could you tell us very briefly what led to those things? Do you think there was any base for the charges, and are they still pending against you?
Yeah, well, according to their concept, I was a fugitive. But according to my concept, I was a refugee from racial oppression. But this case grew out of the fact that I had for many years fought against racial tyranny in the South, that I had fought against racial segregation, racial discrimination, and racial dehumanization. And I became an enemy of the power structure. And because of this, I became also an object of hatred on the part of the local power structure. And the local power structure, through manipulation, because a local Klan lawyer was also Kennedy's White House aide, they were able to manipulate Washington. And
no, just 1 second now. This happened in 1961 in August. At that time, you were head of the Union County branch of the NAACP.
Yes.
There were some freedom riders that had come to your city of Monroe.
Yes.
Right? And you had organized what you called a guard or self-defense force. What was this guard?
Yes, well, the Freedom Riders came for a different purpose. We had a standing guard there to defend the black community against white aggression. And this white aggression was primarily on the part of the Ku Klux Klan, backed up by the local racist police. The Freedom Riders came in to help assist in nonviolent demonstrations. These demonstrations were being conducted for the abolition of police brutality, the abolition of Jim Crow, of Jim Crow facilities, and we had a 10-point program wherein we had asked for fair employment. And
But you weren't, the Freedom Riders were nonviolent demonstrators.
Yes.
At this, you were not participating, though, in their demonstration, as I understand it, your guard, your people.
No, I refused to participate in these demonstrations on the grounds that I would not pledge myself to nonviolence, because I believed, and I've always believed, in self-defense. But I did ask the people, and they accepted reluctantly the idea that they would support these nonviolent demonstrations for a trial, because this was to be a trial to see if we had been in error with our self-defense policy, and to see if nonviolence really had the power of persuasion against these white terrorists.
Now, this guard, though, that you had consisted of about 200 or 300 people who were armed. You had set up foxholes, defense things, and so on. Were you advocating violence then, or was this strictly a self-defense thing for your black community?
Well, I advocated violent self-defense, because I don't think you can really have a defense against violent racist and against terrorists unless you're prepared to meet violence with violence. And my policy was to meet violence with violence.
Oh, would you say that your policy was to fire only when fired upon, or were you going to go out and attack people who you didn't like?
Well, it is commonly known that trenches and foxholes are fixed positions, and these are fixed positions of defense, and this is what we had. But the idea was to protect our communities because law had broken down and the police had refused to protect us. So there was nothing else for men who had self-respect as men to do but to protect their families and their homes.
Now, in this situation of Klan violence, of you setting up foxholes and trenches and so on and arming your neighborhood, what specific event led to this charge against you of kidnapping?
Well, actually, in July and August, we had had some violent attacks on pacifist demonstrators. And on August the 28th, on Sunday afternoon, that the Klan had recruited or solicited support from as far away as Georgia, from Georgia and South Carolina, thousands of Klansmen, Minutemen and other fascist and racist poured into the city, and they had said that they were going to crush this demonstration and that they were going to destroy our branch of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, and most of all that they were going to kill me and to destroy our branch of the NAACP. So we had an armed guard and we had been arming people for quite a while throughout the community. So we prepared to defend ourselves. Also, the Klan had made forays and attacks into our community. They had stoned people. They had thrown missiles from cars, and had 14 women had been struck by these objects. And we were prepared to defend the community. So,
what specifically was the kidnapping charge based upon? What
the kidnapping charge was based upon the fact that some white racists who had been riding around and agitating, and they had had a banner on their car the previous day stating that this was open season on coons, that they had come into a community where many of the people had relatives who had been imprisoned and beaten openly on the streets of Monroe, and these people had come into this community, and these angry people who were about a half a block from my house had taken these people out of a car, and that they had brought them up the block in front of my house, and they had called for me to come out. When I came out, they were threatening to kill them, and these were not people who were members of our guard. These were groups of people roaming the streets who had become angry, and these were people who were not under the discipline of our guard. And so the fact was that I had to come out of the house, and these people were, some were screaming and crying to kill these people, that they were calling them white beasts, and that they were had been responsible for Ku Klux Klan activity, that they should be killed. And I knew that with the tension as high as it was, that they would have been killed. So the crowd was gradually closing in on them. I had to come out. I came down my steps off the porch into the yard, and I started to force the crowd away from them so that they would be arm's length away, because I knew if one person in that crowd struck out at them, that crowd was so angry it would have torn them apart. So
now, just a minute. Now, you had not told anybody to take anyone out of the car. In fact, you didn't know it had happened until the crowd brought these people in front of your house.
No, well, this was a different crowd. The guard that we had, this guard was under orders, and this guard had been pulled back into a rear area waiting for a showdown with the main force of the Klan.
But you didn't tell anyone, you didn't order anyone to take those two people out of their car?
No, there was no need to order anyone to take anyone out of a car. But first thing, we didn't have any facilities for taking anybody. Next thing, if there were enemies enough for any action to be taken, the idea was to use violence against them. But these people didn't use violence at this time. They only wanted to kill these people. And the only reason they didn't kill them was the fact that this woman, Mrs. Stegall, was in the car, because previous cars had passed through and they had been fired on. That I saw groups of men fire M1 rifles and 30 caliber rifles, Italian carbines, and they had tracer bullets, and I saw these bullets penetrating these cars. But in this case, because this woman was in this car, instead of firing on the car, that some of the people just took her out of the car and took this man out. And there was some question, some difference among the crowd as to what must be done.
But now, what did you have to do with
well,
all this?
I didn't have anything to do with it because it occurred a half block from my house, and I was in the house at that time taking care of telephone calls that were coming in from many parts of the county and all over the city of people who wanted to know what had happened to their children who were on the picket lines, and also of people volunteering to join the Guard, and they wanted to come in to fight and make an all-out war and a showdown. But
now these two people were taken into your house, however.
No, they weren't taken into my house. When I came out into the yard, the woman, Mrs. Stegall, said that we have been kidnapped. And I said, well, here, lady, you're not kidnapped. You're free to leave anytime you get ready. And she said, well, if you will take us out, that we will be safe. These people will let us go if you will escort us out of this block. And I told her, no, lady, I'm not going to take you out of here because I didn't bring you here, and I'm not going to take you out. And you're free to leave whenever you get ready.
Well, were you guilty of kidnapping? Did you physically kidnap or force these people to leave their car or enter your house?
They were taken out of the car by a group of people in the streets, and they followed me into my house. They had asked me to take them out of the community, and I refused to do it. So when I turned to go into the house to answer the telephone, they followed me.
Were they afraid? Was that why they followed you into the house?
Yes, they were afraid of the group of angry people, and these people were screaming that they should be killed, and I'm sure they would have killed them if they had stayed there.
So by following you into your house, they felt they'd be safer than out with the crowd. Now, did you make them stay in your house?
No, I didn't make them stay there. In fact, they wanted to stay because they had voluntarily followed me into the house, and they stayed there because they knew that that group in the streets, in the street would have really killed them.
So you personally feel that the charge that you kidnapped anybody or caused them to be kidnapped is unjust. Is that your position?
Yeah, well, it's not that I feel that. I know that. I'm certain of this.
Now, so why is it that you then fled Monroe that night?
Well, the idea was to flee Monroe because there was no justice there, that I was leaving Monroe so that I wouldn't be in the community because we thought it was going to be a big showdown and a lot of people would be killed, and they knew that I was going to be blamed for everything there. So the local people said that I should go away for a week or two until it was over and return.
Now, did you feel that your life was threatened? Is that why you left, or why?
Well, I felt my life was threatened, but that wasn't why I left. The idea was that I wouldn't be on the scene and that they wouldn't be able to frame me, that anything that would happen, I wouldn't be held responsible because it would be known that I was not in the community at the time.
Now, what happened to these two people that were in your house? Were they still there when you left, or had they been freed?
They were still there when I left, and according to the papers, when they left, they just left themselves, and they left free.
Were they harmed or what?
Well, according to the testimony of the people themselves, they were not harmed.
So, but you feel that this that was the charge against you, that you had caused them to, you and May Mallory and these other people had caused them to be taken out of their car and into your house, and this constituted kidnapping?
Well, this was their charge, but the fact is that none of the people who stopped them in the streets were indicted. That they only indicted the people they wanted to indict, and they weren't interested in any of the people. About 200 or 300 people stopped them, according to their own admission. But none of the people who were indicted were in the group that stopped them.
Now, who were the people who were indicted? I mean, what type of people were they? Why were they indicted?
Well, one was a white freedom rider from New York, John Lowry. May Mallory was a housewife, a mother of two children, and two local fellows, Harold Reap and James Crowder. And these people were actually students. They were youth. And they were also youth leaders. So the idea was not to punish anybody for a kidnap, not to punish anybody who had stopped these people, but they had certain people they wanted to get rid of in the community.
Now, what has happened to the other people, the ones that stayed in the United States, who were indicted on that kidnapping charge?
Well, they are living normal lives in New York. That John Lowry is working in a bank, and I understand that he is now a junior bank official. May Mallory is working in a hospital and is traveling freely. In fact, she's just recently been here, and she was issued a passport to come here. That the other two youths are also living in New York, and the trial has not, since it was thrown out by the Supreme Court of North Carolina on the ground of racial discrimination and jury selection, it has not been recalled.
So in other words, the original charge against you, the people who were indicted, who were captured, the their conviction was thrown out by the North Carolina State Supreme Court, and they are presently, what, under indictment or what?
Yes, the conviction was thrown out, but they were re-indicted. And this is more of a threat, a form of intimidation, than an active case, because they were re-indicted, but none of them have been picked up to be returned to the state of North Carolina.
So is it your feeling the state of North Carolina is not going to try to press this case?
Well, evidently not, because they didn't press it up until this time, and they seem to be only interested in me.
And this whole thing happened now more than 7 years ago.
Yes, more than 7 years ago.
So now, you fled, however. I heard that you were told that the sheriff was going to hang you or your body was going to be in the town square or something, that there was they were directly threatening to kill you.
Mm-hmm. Yes, this was the chief of police, who said that in 30 minutes, the state troopers were already coming to town, and that in 30 minutes I would be hanging up in the courthouse square.
Well, now, to make, I know it was a very complicated story, but in essence, you left Monroe, you got to New York and found out there was a federal warrant for your arrest for leaving the state of North Carolina.
Yes.
And you subsequently went to Canada as a fugitive.
Yes.
And then through a roundabout means through California and Mexico, got to Cuba.
Yes.
Now, you were in Cuba from 1961 up until 1966.
Yes.
Well, why Cuba of all places? Why to a communist country so you could be accused of being a pro-communist propagandist instead of a real Afro-American freedom fighter just working for equality of the American Negro people? I mean, why to Cuba?
I was given political asylum in Cuba. And I was there as an exile in Cuba, and I lived there as an exile.
Now, were there any particular Cuban leaders who gave you this asylum, or was it just, in general, the government there?
Well, actually, this political exile was given to me under the direct orders of Fidel Castro himself.
Why did he do this?
Well, he did this because, first thing, I had been a friend of Cuba. I had visited there on two occasions before, and the fact that the Cubans were convinced that under the racist laws in the United States, especially in the South, that it would be impossible for a black person to obtain justice. So they gave me this on the grounds that I couldn't get justice in a racist country.
Now, do you feel that the Cubans were using you to make propaganda against the United States?
No, I don't think they were deliberately using me, because there was some division in Cuba as to whether or not I should be allowed to enter there. And it so happened that Fidel himself took the position that I should be. And actually, he had to go against some of the party officials to reach this conclusion. So it wasn't a matter of just allowing me to be there on the grounds of propaganda.
Now, you say he had to go against some of the... You mean that the Communist Party of Cuba opposed your coming to Cuba?
Well, not the Communist Party as a whole, but some of the members in the party and some of the other people in Cuba, and also those who had close connections with the U.S. Communist Party, because the U.S. Communist Party was opposed to my going to Cuba, and they tried to use their influence in Cuba to prevent my entrance into Cuba.
Why was the U.S. Communist Party, why do you feel they were opposed to you going to Cuba?
Well, the first thing was that I didn't belong to the U.S. Communist Party, and I was considered a black nationalist, and they opposed black nationalism. So they didn't want me in Cuba because they felt that they could no longer speak for the black people in America if they really had a genuine black person from the movement who had been in struggle. And this would have taken away some of their authority in Cuba. So they didn't want me there because they felt it would be a conflict between my black nationalism and their class theory.
Now, excuse me. Now, the arrival in Cuba, your arrival in Cuba, gave you certain facilities. That is to say, the Cuban government permitted you and helped you in publishing your newsletter, The Crusader, and also in making radio broadcasts to the United States on your radio station. It was called Radio Free Dixie. Do you feel that giving you these facilities was more than just asylum, but in fact was helping you make propaganda for black nationalism?
Well, actually, it was because the Cubans had made it plain that they support the liberation struggles of the peoples of the world, and they considered our struggle no exception. And the fact was that I had asked for this time and this program, And some of the party officials did not approve of it, and it was necessary for Fidel himself to intervene in this. And some of the party officials felt that I should be under the regular Cuban party propaganda. But Fidel Castro took the position that I was a freedom fighter from the United States, and that as a black American, that I knew more about what the propaganda should be than anybody. So his position was to leave him alone and to let him determine what he should do.
Now, while you were in Cuba, your wife, Mabel, and your two boys managed to get to Cuba from the United States, and they lived there with you.
Yes.
You had your own house there in Cuba, furnished
yes.
by the Cuban government. Now, did you ever feel that what you were doing was in any way an act of treason or unpatriotism towards your country, towards the United States of America, or had you abandoned America? Did you feel you were now a Cuban, or what?
No, I don't believe any man who lives under tyranny in a government can ever be truthfully accused of treason. Treason can only come when a man is entitled to the rights and privileges, and he is protected by his government, and then he betrays that government, then he can be accused of treason. But when the government betrays its trust to its people, then the government is what is guilty, is the guilty party to treason. And I consider the government of the United States to have failed the black people in America in protecting the rights of black people in the enforcement of the Constitution. So it wasn't a matter of treason, but it was a matter of constitutional betrayal on the part of the United States of America, on the part of the government and the so-called decent people in America.
This is The Crusader. This was your monthly newsletter from Cuba. It's the issue of May, June 64. I mean, there's a cartoon here, Afro-American Revolt, the Racist USA, the Torch of Retribution. And we see what appears to be an Afro-American lighting fire to buildings. Now, if you were going to put out something of this kind, don't you think that it would have been better to do it in a neutral country so that people couldn't say, well, this is just anti-U.S. communist propaganda coming from Cuba, that you've been a tool of the Cubans?
Neutral country? As far as the black man is concerned, there's no such thing as a neutral country in the world. Either a country is for justice, either a country is for the liberation of the oppressed, or that it is against it. That there's no such thing as neutrality under justice. That either you've got to be for justice or against it. Now, as a black man in America, I went to the countries that would accept me. Now, since I've been in Cuba and China, I've tried to go to France, I've tried to go to Sweden. I expected Sweden to be a neutral country. I expected France to be a neutral country, but I discovered that they're not neutral, that they're with the United States government. I was in Canada. I had hoped to stay in Canada. I had been there for a month. But then I discovered that the Royal Canadian Mounted Police had entered the search for me, and that the response of the United States government was seeking to return me to the racist United States.
But even though the Royal Canadian Mounted Police had entered the search for you, and later on you couldn't get into France and Sweden and places like that, why did you feel it necessary to send out something that is so obviously inflammatory and an agitational pamphlet? Didn't you realize that by it coming from Cuba, even though you were publishing it yourself, that people in the United States would say this is just anti-U.S. communist propaganda? They wouldn't read what was in it.
But it makes no difference what the people in the United States say. If they were concerned with justice, they would be speaking out against the racial injustice there, and it wouldn't be necessary to publish such publications as this. The fact is that I belong to an oppressed group, an oppressed class, an oppressed race, and it is my duty to agitate for the liberation of these people, for the freedom of our people, no matter what the enemy may say, no matter what impression I may give. Now, Cuba was a place that I could freely work, and a person who is truly interested in justice must work from wherever he can. So I worked from Cuba.
So you do not feel that your publications in any way caused the Watts or Detroit or Newark riots?
No, I feel that Washington and the American people, the apathy of the American people, at least those in the power structure, actually responsible for these riots. No, that I'm a victim of those same conditions. So it is the duty that I'm duty bound to oppose this any way that I can, by any means necessary, and to advocate a policy of the elimination of these conditions, and I don't care what the cost is or what method I must use. And I'm happy to know if this method is proven successful, then I'm happy. I feel happy about it that I am accomplishing my objective.
Well, getting back to Cuba, what were conditions like for you in Cuba? You had a long interview with Che Guevara before he left Cuba, just shortly before he vanished. Why did you leave Cuba? There have been stories that you felt threatened in Cuba, that you had serious problems after being in Cuba almost 5 years. Why did you leave there? What was your situation? What did Guevara have to say to you, and why did you leave?
Well, I didn't feel threatened in Cuba. Fact was that I wasn't being as effective in Cuba as I had been, as I felt that I could be. Fact was that the Cuban government, or some faction in the government, had started to sabotage my work, and I discovered that they weren't really interested in the elimination of these oppressive conditions in the United States, that they wanted to create an image as revolutionaries, but they didn't want to do anything. They didn't want me to do anything, that they just wanted to support me there, or pretend to support me, without really taking any concrete steps, and they did everything they could to keep me from promoting black nationalism and an effective struggle for our people. So I left.
Yeah, but they did give you radio broadcast facilities and facilities for publishing and getting, what, about 40,000 of these things a month into the States. How were they sabotaging you?
Yeah, well, they, in the beginning they had helped me, but actually it wasn't the government that started to print these publications. Actually, the Cuban workers, the printers, agreed to do this, and these publications were being printed before the government even realized it. And they were even being sent into the States. But then after the government realized it, the government did start to support this, because they saw it as a good propaganda thing. But the thing about it is the government tried more and more to patch up some differences with the United States government. More and more they started putting pressure on me. They started sabotaging. And they didn't sabotage my life there. And they supported me up until the end as an individual, but they didn't want to do anything that would rouse the antagonism of the United States government.
Now, just a minute. You think that you say that the Cuban government was trying not to antagonize the U.S. government? Why was that?
Yes, they were trying not to do this. Evidently, they were trying to reach some agreement on the exiles in the United States, the Cuban exiles. And
you mean to keep the exiles from attacking Cuba, they would stop you from attacking the United States?
That's what actually the United States government had already started intervening, and they had started restraining the Cuban exiles in the United States. So I suppose it's just my assumption. I don't have any concrete evidence, but I assume that this was reciprocal and that the Cuban government also started restraining me.
Well, what about your relationships with Che Guevara? Did he sponsor you? In other words, were you doing what he thought should be done, like starting one, two, many Vietnams, whatever his slogan was?
Well, I had had a long discussion with Che on the eve before his disappearance, and he had said that they had some differences in the government. He had said that he differed with them, and he thought that I should receive more support from the Cuban government, and that the Afro-Americans in the United States should receive more support.
Now, what was his difference with the other people in the Cuban government?
Well, according to what he had stated, was the difference in the revolutionary belief, the fact that he believed in a revolution. He believed that Cuba should support the revolutionary movements, and that more and more the Cuban government was not supporting the revolutionary movement. So this was his difference, basically.
Now, when you say support the revolutionary movements, do you consider the movement for equality for American Negroes to be a revolutionary movement?
Yes, well, it's developing into a revolutionary movement, and the fact was that we could see this potential. And everybody knows that that there can be no political freedom or economic freedom for the black people in America without revolutionary conditions or without revolutionary activity.
Well, now here, in your Crusader newsletter, you started out with this letterhead, this man, medieval crusader on horseback. However, you've changed it in the last couple of years to the machine gun and the torch. Now, I get the impression from this, and many people do, that when you say revolution, you mean violence, you mean arson, you mean destruction. You just don't mean a change in the American way of life.
Well, this change took place because of changing times. That when I first started with the Crusader Man on Horse, those were different conditions. That they were the conditions of people who believed in Gandhi, people who believed in Christianity. And these boycotts and demonstrations were led by a lot of church people.
Martin Luther King and so on.
Yes. And so we believed in that. But this is a matter of evolution, that I didn't decide to change this masthead myself, but many people wrote in, many of the black people in the black communities who were distributing this, and they said that they didn't think this was an appropriate symbol for the new movement, for the new mood. And so this is why we adapted this new masthead with the machine gun and the torch.
Yeah, and this was, but you changed this after what? That is to say, after 1965 was when you changed.
Yes, because this was the new era of the bullet, of the fire and the bullet. So it was time to change. This was no longer just a religious or philosophical crusade, but this was a new era that had entered the stage of history.
Now, when you say new era, you mean that you arbitrarily decided that the bullet and the arson's torch, the Molotov cocktail, that this was going to be the way you were going to express yourself?
No, the people in the streets decided this. And they wrote to me and they suggested and some even demanded that I get in step with this new tendency because it had come and they knew that I was with it, but they didn't think that this was giving the right image, this masthead, so I changed it.
Now, when you left Cuba, was there any particular incident that forced you to leave Cuba? Were there any particular individuals who forced you to leave Cuba?
There were many incidents and some certain individuals, because the Cuban people always supported me, the revolutionaries supported me, the military men supported me, but there were a few people, a few leaders around Fidel, like Comandante Vallejo, Comandante Piñera, and Osmani Cienfuegos. These people had tried to sabotage the Afro-American struggle, and they were pretending to be party people and pretending to be great leftists and Marxist-Leninists, but all the time they were sabotaging what I was doing and doing everything to make my struggle ineffective and I stay uncomfortable in Cuba.
Now, when you say sabotaging, there has to be a reason for this. If you think they were trying to sabotage your work, your radio broadcast, your publishing of your newsletter, why do you think they were doing this?
I think they were doing it because there had been some infiltration into the Cuban intelligence, and Piñera was also one of the intelligence officials. And he was either being misled, being fed misinformation, he was working directly for the United States and for the CIA.
You think that the CIA was that deep into the Cuban government that they could surround the people, touch the people surrounding Fidel and actually stop what you were doing when he wanted it done?
Well, I don't think that. I know that because I had close contact with them and I know what they were able to do.
I mean, do you think the CIA did this or was it someone else? Do you think maybe the Russians did it?
Well, it appears that the CIA did it because all that was done was pro-American and it would have benefited America more than anybody else or any other country. But it could be that it was a joint operation or it could have been some other country. But I know that it was done because I was the victim of it.
So their specific actions caused you to believe that you had to leave Cuba?
Well, if I wanted to carry on my struggle for the liberation of the black people in America, if I could live true to what I believed, I had to leave Cuba. But I wasn't forced out of Cuba, that I had a choice of remaining there. But I could have remained in Cuba as a socialist Uncle Tom. But I didn't see any difference in being a socialist Uncle Tom than in being an Uncle Tom in capitalist and racist America. And I'm not cut out to be an Uncle Tom, no matter who is for.
Now, why did you go to China, to the mainland of China, what we call communist China in the States? Why didn't you go to a neutral country at this time?
Well, I had tried to go to Sweden. I tried to go to Sweden from Cuba. I tried to go to Canada. I applied for a visa. I applied to immigration, the Canadian immigration. I filled out a form, and they rejected me. There was no place else to go but China. So the Chinese people and the Chinese government received me with open arms, and I'm grateful to them for this, and I would also always be grateful to them. But where else could a black freedom fighter go in the world but to the People's Republic of China?
Now, when you arrived in China, this was in 1966, did the Chinese offer you facilities, such as propaganda facilities, broadcast facilities, newspaper facilities? In other words, were you able to keep putting out the things that you've been doing in Cuba?
Yes, that I had the opportunity to do what I was doing in Cuba and more. The Chinese only stated that they supported me, and they supported the black people in America, and that I should ask them what I wanted to do, should tell them. And if I had any special requests, all I had to do was to make these requests. And this was the position of the Chinese government, this was the position of the Chinese people, that they didn't take any active part in this, but they left it up to me as a matter of principle, the principle that they support revolutionary people and struggling peoples in the world.
Now, are you working for the communist Chinese government? Are you their agent or a spokesman for them today?
No, I've never been a spokesman, I've never been an agent, and I've never been on their payroll. I live in China as an exile. They have given me political asylum as an exile. They support my struggle. They never dictate any policy to me, and my propaganda is completely divorced from theirs. And anybody who studies the situation closely can see that there is some difference in my propaganda and Chinese propaganda. And the Chinese allow me to produce my propaganda without interference. And they have never asked me to change my way of thinking. They've never tried to pressure me into making any decision that I didn't want to make.
Yet you wear a Mao Zedong button. This would indicate that you have accepted the philosophy of Chairman Mao and that you are a supporter of it.
Yes, that I believe that he has done a lot of good for China, that he's brought the Chinese people a great distance in a short length of time. He is one of the great leaders of history, and that Chairman Mao means more to more than just, means something to more than just communists in the world, that he is also a defender of the rights of the poor, of the oppressed.
Now, do you mean by that Afro-Americans, that American Negroes, should follow the teachings of Mao Zedong?
Yes, they should follow the teachings. Now, because of the fact that Chairman Mao says himself that in every situation that the people must determine what they can use and what they can't use, and that nothing should be forced from the outside, that the people in their respective communities must decide and must fashion the methods that they use. So I suggest that from his own teachings that they follow this. This means that any struggle in the United States need not necessarily be following the blueprint of the Chinese Revolution, even the Chinese philosophy.
Yeah, but don't you realize that by wearing a Mao Zedong pin and by saying that Afro-Americans should follow the teachings of Chairman Mao, that you in fact substantiate the claims by people in the United States that the uprisings, that the burnings of American cities are fomented, organized, and supported by the Red Chinese?
I've learned long ago not to be too much influenced and concerned with what people say, especially in a negative way, in this negative vein. There are many people in the United States who say that I'm a kidnapper, but I've never kidnapped anybody. There are some people who say I'm a criminal, but I've never committed any criminal act. So I can't be concerned. Look, I am a refugee. I'm a victim of all kinds of racial oppression, tyranny, and terror in the United States. So why should I be concerned with what they think about me or what they call me? My first concern is liberation. My first concern is justice and freedom. And it makes no difference what they call me. It makes no difference what they think, because in the final analysis, they are going to have to face reality. And the reality is that America is not God, America is not the end of the earth, and it doesn't matter what the Americans think. In the final analysis, the truth will come out, and they're going to have to face it, no matter what it is.
Now, just a minute. Are you admitting, or are you acknowledging that the Red Chinese are supporting, fomenting riots in American cities, and maybe even sending in arms and money to people to destroy America?
Chinese, as far as I know, and I think I'm closer to them than any other American, and I've never known them to send in any money nor arms to America. That the Chinese support the Afro-Americans morally, and the Chinese have asked what the Afro-Americans want.
Now, this is a pamphlet that you wrote in China, and it's called Listen, Brother, by Robert F. Williams, and is directed at American GIs, at Afro-American GIs fighting in Vietnam. Now, you've used things in it like photographs of American cities, of rioting, of fighting between police and civilians, and also photos which are quite terrible of some of the corpses from, let's say, this one is from the Newark rioting, a man shot 17 times by the police. And you have statements in here referring to black and white Americans saying, both of us together can't beat the Viet Cong. The man, meaning white America, wouldn't have a possible chance with us against him, too.
Well,
what do you mean by this?
First thing, this pamphlet was written in Peking, but it was printed in New York, the United States of America. Next thing is, those pictures are in there. Yes, they're on display. But I didn't commit those crimes. The black people in America didn't commit those crimes. Those crimes were committed by white America and by white America's running dog cops who murdered innocent people on the streets of America. And if these pictures are so horrible, then how much more horrible and terrifying are the actual acts are visited against our people.
And yeah, but you're asking here for American soldiers to commit treason, to actually turn and fight against their own country.
I'm not asking them to commit treason. I'm asking them to stop betraying humanity. I'm asking them not to commit treason against humanity. Man's first duty is to his brother. Man's first duty is to humanity, not to governments, not to brutal, savage governments and oppressors. This was what the German soldiers said. The German soldiers were obeying the Third Reich, the government of Hitler. So this is no excuse. This thing about treason, to threaten people with treason because they refuse to be brutes, because they refuse to resort to the methods of tyranny. No, this is not asking treason. This is asking humanity.
Yeah, but wait a minute. You're not only asking people not to fight the Viet Cong, you're asking them to take up arms against the U.S. government, to destroy the U.S. government. That's more than just not being involved in brutal acts. You're asking them to commit brutality against their fellow Americans.
That's asking to put an end to tyranny, just like in the colonies of the United States when Britain was visiting tyranny on the colonies. It was not enough just not to serve the crown, but the idea was to stop the crown from oppressing others, to eliminate tyranny from the soil of the colonies. And this is what is being requested here. It's not enough for an Afro-American not to kill Vietnamese, but it is his duty to prevent this war machine from crushing his own people, from crushing his people in the streets of racist America. And the idea is that the black man, if he's going to fight, if he's going to be a soldier, he should fight for the liberation of his own people. He's got no business in Vietnam. And the idea is that he's fighting for his own enemy, for the rights of his enemy to oppress others, to destroy others. But he is not fighting for his right to live as a human being or his mother in the United States of America. And what I'm saying is, if they force him into battle, if they force him to kill, then the people he should kill are those who are oppressing him, and those are the white Americans of the United States.
Now you say all white Americans, everybody with light skin, should be killed? What are you saying?
No, I'm not saying that all white Americans should be killed. But I'm saying that those who are killing and murdering Vietnamese in cold blood, the same as they're murdering and killing black people in the streets of Washington, in the streets of Detroit, in Chicago, in Los Angeles, in San Francisco, I'm saying that they deserve to be killed by black soldiers who have gone to kill others in their name and on their behalf.
But what you're saying, if people listen to what you say and try to do what you say, this will result in the death of millions of people. This will result in the death of most black Americans.
You mean it will result in the death of white people in America? Because our people have been being killed in America with impunity for almost 400 years. We've lost millions of people. In fact, Lord Bertrand Russell has said that more Afro-Americans have been exterminated in the United States than Hitler exterminated Jews in Germany. So when you start talking about losing millions of people, you're not talking about black people, you're talking about white people. And if white people insist on murdering our people and practicing genocide against our people, then they have a right to be murdered. And this becomes our duty to end this.
Yeah, but now, don't you think that being out of the United States for almost 8 years now, that you're a little out of touch with what's been happening? There have been great strides made in civil rights. There have been many bills passed. The work of late Reverend King was essential in these things. And white Americans are trying very hard to try to do something about the situation. There's no genocide being committed. There are no concentration camps or gas chambers. You've been involved in this great cultural revolution in China. Perhaps this has gotten you a little out of touch with the United States today, because I'm sure that there are a great many white Americans that think that what you're saying now is way out.
Out of touch? Is it way out that Reverend King is dead? Who killed Reverend King? Reverend King is dead, so I'm out of touch with reality. It appears to me that conditions have worsened. It appears to me that I'm behind time, that I'm too moderate in the view of this, because here is a pacifist, one of the great followers of Gandhi, a man who advocated love and nonviolence, has been shot down in the streets of racist America and killed like a common street dog. Now, and then I'm supposed to be moderate in my outlook, I'm supposed to be merciful. This is asking more of me as a victim than has been asked of the oppressor.
Well, but you're calling for an attack on hundreds of millions of people based upon the act of one man.
But not a matter of an act of one man. That mankind is responsible for his fellow man. That society is a collective community. And you cannot be aloof in a community where you live. The German people allowed Hitler to lead them down the drain. They allowed Hitler to rage and to act like a maniac. And they didn't take any position whatever. They supported Germany. They supported their government. And as a result of this, we can see what happened. Now, the American people can't hide behind the excuse that they are not doing it, that they are not committing these crimes. But they are absolutely responsible for these crimes, because these crimes are being committed in the name of the American people, by a government that states it is a government of the people, for the people, and by the people.
But the American government didn't kill Reverend King, or for that matter, Robert Kennedy or President Kennedy.
But it tolerated the death of Martin Luther King. It didn't prevent the death of Martin Luther King. And the 14th Amendment says that every citizen is equal, is entitled to equal protection under law. Now, the J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI says that they know every time some conspiracy is being formulated in the ghetto. They know about plots they claim against leaders like Roy Wilkins and Whitney Young. They know when the statues are going to be blown up. They know when people are planning to set off bombs. But they didn't know when the President of the United States was about to be killed. They didn't know when Martin Luther King was about to be killed. They didn't know when Bobby Kennedy was about to be killed. Now, what is all of this about? All of this good protection and know-how and protection of people like Roy Wilkins and Whitney Young and these people, and no protection of the Kennedys and the Kings.
Well, do you think that the Kennedys aren't Afro-Americans? They're white Americans.
Yeah, they are white Americans, but they have run afoul of the rightist forces in the United States, the same as Reverend King.
Well, then aren't your enemies certain forces in the United States and not white society as a whole?
There are certain forces in the United States, but the fact is that when you have a community that is becoming degenerate and that is being overrun by degenerates, and that degeneracy is becoming an order of the day, then no honest man can take an inactive position. No honest man can be neutral. And if honest men are neutral, then they are not neutral, and they are not honest, but they become accessories after the fact and after the act and to the act.
All right, now, you have been in China. You have been given honors and position that no American citizen, practically no private person in the world has ever had. For example, you have been allowed to stand next to Chairman Mao on the Gate of Heavenly Peace, the Capitol building in Peking, and actually take the microphone and speak to 2.5 million people. Why do you think that you as an individual, you, Robert Franklin Williams, have been given these honors and this position, is incredible support, at least moral support, if you claim no arms, by the communist government in China?
Because I'm the first black victim of racial oppression and tyranny to have been able to escape this network of tyrants. The first one to land on a friendly soil, or to land on soil where they are opposed to this type of tyranny. So it is only natural that the Chinese people would want to hear what I've got to say. Not only do they want to hear what I've got to say, but they think others in the world who are victims and potential victims of the same injustice, the racist oppression and injustice, that the people who are potentially targets of this should know the nature, the true nature of America.
Now, in China, and I realize it's impossible to discuss this in a short period of time, this would take hours, but in China, you've been living through this great cultural revolution that they're calling, which has, in many ways, torn Chinese society apart. People in the States don't know much about this. What's going on in China? What are the forces involved? What is this cultural revolution? Can you just say it very simply?
Well, it will actually be impossible for the people in the United States to understand the Cultural Revolution in China or anything about China, because they don't have enough background to understand what's going on. But actually, basically, what has taken place is that the Chinese youth and the Chinese workers and peasants and soldiers, under the direction and teaching of Chairman Mao, are trying to develop a new society that will mold a new kind of man, a new kind of individual, the type of individual that the Christians claimed they wanted to produce many years ago, and that is that there will be men who will be honest, men who will be devoid of ego, men who will work for the collective good of all, men who will not put their selfish motives ahead of those of their fellow men. And this is basically is what they're trying to do, the objective. Now, there's nothing that says that they are going to succeed. There's no certainty of this. In fact, Mao Zedong himself has said that there's a possibility that they may lose, but this is what they're trying to do. And they're having much trouble and friction because there are some who support socialism, some who support communism, some who support Mao Zedong, but who don't think that they can overcome this feeling of personal gain, that they can overcome ego. And some people are opposed to this because it requires a great deal. You must try to imagine what it requires of a person to think more of humanity, to think more of the people in his community than of himself and his own immediate family.
You mean they're trying to create a society where people won't work to get more pay or won't work to get bonuses? In other words, the whole direction that Russia is going in, this Liebermanism and things like that, is to let workers participate in factory profits. Are you saying that the Chinese are trying to motivate people just by idealism? That certainly would cause a conflict.
Well, as are the people themselves. You see, this is the strange thing about it. It's not the government trying to force the people to accept this philosophy, but many of the people, and especially the peasants themselves and soldiers, are saying that this must be done. This is the type of society they want, and that they are actually striving to produce a type of personality wherein man's satisfaction for his work will come from the satisfaction of creating for the good of all, for the good of humanity. That he will derive his compensation from the fact that he knows that he is contributing to humanity.
What do you see for the United States? You're an American. You still say you're an American citizen. What do you think is going to happen there in the States?
Well, I think great turmoil is going to take place there. And what we've seen today is just a sample of what is developing in the world, a new attitude that there's much contempt and much hatred for America because of its imperialist attitude, because of its capitalist attitude in dealing with others, because of its racist attitude, And people in the world are beginning to get tired of this. And more they're beginning to complain. And more they're beginning to see the United States as the devil power of the earth. And not only the people outside, but our people inside, the black people, are beginning to see America as serving serving as the devil to make life miserable for the good people of the world or the struggling peoples. So I can foresee the day when, unless America changes, and unless it changes soon, it is going to be completely destroyed. It's going to be wiped off the first face of the earth, because it is impossible for a nation to serve the devil and to do such evil to others and exist. And it was Abraham Lincoln himself who said that a nation divided among itself cannot stand, and America is divided.
Now, but when you say wiped off the face of the earth, there's no power on earth that will dare to attack us, or we can destroy Russia or China or anybody else that tries us. What are you talking about when you say wiped off the face of the earth?
Well, when I say wiped off the face of the earth, I mean that part of it is going to come from within America. America's already about to destroy itself. America now is in such a sorry state that even the President of the United States is not safe, unless he's a rightist. That a man who was Attorney General, a man who was an aspirant for the presidency, can be killed openly in the streets.
But that's not the destruction of the United States.
No, but this is the beginning. This shows that there's something seriously wrong, and this shows that the society is becoming so degenerate and so many explosions are taking place among the people that it can't possibly stand, plus the fact it's suffering defeat in Vietnam, and more that the peoples of the world are beginning to resist, and they're going to resist more. And all of these forces brought together, including the degeneracy inside the country, is going to bring about its destruction. That's all it is to it.
Yeah, but you're talking the abstract here. In your newsletter, in your radio broadcast in the past, And in many statements that you've made, you've been quite specific. You've said that Afro-Americans are going to blow up American factories, dynamite Hoover Dam, destroy the railroad lines, destroy electrical power lines. You tell how to make Molotov cocktails, how to attack the police. Aren't you, in fact, advocating, preaching that Afro-Americans should try to destroy American industry and bring chaos to American cities?
I'm preaching for my people the same thing that George Washington and Patrick Henry preach for their people in another time, in another day. That I'm preaching that we must use any means necessary in order to liberate ourselves, and that we have no right to submit to tyranny. I'm saying that we must become men, and we must resist, and we must use any means, no matter what it requires. And the fact that I'm more concerned with the liberation of people, I'm more concerned with humanity and the human flesh than with buildings, than with the loss of property. You see, this is a cold capitalist version of the fact that we must save the property. But I'm interested in saving the people, and the black people have a right to be saved as much as anybody. And unless white America is willing to liberate the black people and to stop oppressing us, then if America must go up in smoke, then let it go, let it go, let it burn.
Vibration. It's instant. Resonate.
I can't believe you can stop.
It's that curl in the afro, that twang on the guitar, that Ravi Shankar 12 string on the sitar, that Coltrane saxophone blowing like a cigar, Malcolm by the window with his finger on the trigger. The shock with the doctors can't find with x-rays, the pain in your gut is passed down from ex-slaves. The black Buddha within, on the lotus, sitting on the dock of the bay, getting red with Otis. That soul sonic band by the gold teeth Ebonics, James Brown in the pocket, Mississippi gut bucket, chi overflowing like rum, the vibration of your palm flapping against a goat skin drum, the soul in the folk song, the story in the tat, the old school drop top with bass in the back. It's my natural disposition, I was born like that, it's engraved in my soul like boobs in the wax. I got soul power.
We will shake.
That real soul power, yeah, rocking that soul power. Check it out, hey, want you to take a walk with me. Yeah, this that nigga town poem by Al Prentice Carter, the murder that made Martin a martyr. This is that break from the cycle that ended with Carmichael up in Lowndes County, Alabama, cocking them hammers. It was the white rooster versus them black jungle cats, made them lift up their seats, take a peek under that, the stench of a rotten system, ill-gotten. And if you listen, you can hear survivors off in the distance, the undeniable spirit of the fire, the old reliable unseen force, when you need it, it takes you higher. It's the Rose Keys in the church choir, it's the heat, it's the speakers, the turntables and wires, it's desire, it's the beautiful act that inspires crowds to riot, and non-believers left with their jaws dropped in silence. The difference between philosophical non-violence and black power, it's karma, we're coming for hours.
Let's get it of this unjust society, and put an end to poverty as we walk together.